I'd like to call to order today's meeting of the Public Safety Policy and Finance Committee on January 27, 2005. Clerk, take the roll.
Chairman Smith?
Here.
Representative Eastland? Cornish? Ellison?
Here.
Hillstrom?
Here.
Johnson? Meslow? Murphy?
Here.
Nelson? Newman?
Here.
Tamar?
Here.
Soderstrom?
Here.
We're short at quorum, despite that, so we are going to hold the minutes for later. But we are this morning, members, going to be presented with an impact of alcohol and other drugs on the justice system, model drug court rules presentation by State Chemical Health Team, and then also various other testifiers as listed on the agenda. We do have session at noon, so I would like to attempt to conclude all presentations by approximately 20 minutes of the hour of noon. So if there are questions, I would appreciate if you could make note of those, and then we'll raise questions at the end of the presentation. So with that, having said that, the impact of alcohol and other drugs on the justice system. Ladies, good morning.
Good morning. Representative and Sheriff Smith and the rest of the committee members. My name is Joanne Smith, and I'm a judge in Ramsey County District Court, the Second Judicial District, which is in St. Paul and the surrounding areas. I'm here today along with Mary Ellison from, she's the Deputy Commissioner of Public Safety, and hopefully soon joining us will be Sheriff Jim Frank from Washington County, the Washington County Sheriff. And we have some other people here with us today who I'll introduce in a bit. But I first of all like to thank you so very much and very sincerely for this opportunity to be here today. The issue that we're here to talk about is an issue that is really driving so much of what we see in the courts and in many other sectors within our system. So we're here today to share some information with you and to not only talk about the problem, but to talk about some promising solutions that we hope could provide some additional information to you as you do your work throughout your job, of course, during this legislative session. I'd like to start with just a hopefully somewhat of a brief introduction. In July of 2003, the state Supreme Court, through Associate Justice James Gilbert, convened a group of leaders and representatives from a number of state-level entities with a stake in the issue of alcohol and other drugs. And this was focused and came to be really because of several significant developments that were just convening within our state at the time. First of all, there was a somewhat, the legislature had requested and had received a report of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, and that report came to the legislature in 2003, or actually, I believe it was sometime last year, but it was a 2003 report on the sentencing practices of the courts on specifically drug offenders in the state. One of the other convening forces that was happening at the time was an opportunity for a state-level team of stakeholders in these issues to participate in federally funded training, and that training was directed towards one of the solutions to the problem that's been identified, and that is substance abuse or drug courts. And with that opportunity for training, it seemed that this was a good time to get a collaborative group of individuals together. The other convening force at the time was really the stated and growing interest of judges and other stakeholders within the justice system in developing or at least exploring drug courts in the state of Minnesota. And, of course, underlying all of this is the growing and ever-increasing, frankly, alarm within the court system about the impact of alcohol and other drug issues that the Minnesota justice system, particularly the criminal justice system, has been experiencing. So with all of that coming together, whether it be the stars or however it was, Justice Gilbert seized upon this opportunity to convene this group. The initial purpose, then, of this group coming together was to simply just explore concerns and issues in order to determine whether there was reasons to exist as a group, and then if we thought that we had a reason to exist, to explore opportunities to come together in a deliberate way to address them. And the way that we did this was to attend these trainings, and we attended trainings in over the course of last year. One training was held in South Carolina, the other training was held in Florida. The partners in this effort at that point in time included representatives from public safety. Mary Ellison was a representative from public safety, of course, as deputy commissioner of public safety, law enforcement, prosecution, defense, the commissioner of corrections, commissioner of health, commissioner of human services, treatment, chemical dependency treatment representatives, legislators, community representatives through an organization known as CLUES, a Minneapolis City Council member was part of the group, also others that we felt that should be at the table that weren't initially at the table were later invited to join us. The first meeting of that group occurred on February 27th of last year, and I remember it very well. It was sort of a dream come true for me to see that this level of individuals about this issue would be willing to come and sit at the same table and talk about what we were experiencing within our communities and certainly how that impacted the courts. The training then, from the training, I guess, what the group decided, we were known as the State Chemical Health Team, and that's kind of an informal title at the time. We didn't really know what to call ourselves. We didn't know if we were going to continue to exist after this training. But through the training, we developed a mission, and it became apparent to us that we needed some kind of, from the players that were at the table, the players really felt at the table that we needed to, in some respects, become an officially sanctioned group. And the way that the group felt that that could really happen was for the trial courts, through the Conference of Chief Judges, to support this effort. And then, if that was really support there in the trenches, so to speak, recognizing that these efforts need to be local efforts, then for the Supreme Court to recognize that and to sanction it. So we went to the Conference of Chief Judges, received unanimous support there, then proceeded to the Supreme Court. And I'm happy to report that the Supreme Court has accepted this proposal that we form and create a task force now on, it's going to be called the Supreme Court Task Force on Chemical Dependency, in the state of Minnesota. This task force is in the process now of being formed in terms of the membership, and we're anticipating, and at least it's my hope, that we will have our first meeting sometime in March. That may be a little optimistic as things move, but that is at least my hope, as having served as chair now of the state chemical health team. What we're looking now to do is to, and this is really our mission statement, is to establish this group to increase public safety, improve life outcomes, and to save taxpayer dollars by developing and promoting strategies that better integrate the justice system, and not just the criminal justice system, but the justice system and chemical dependency services across the state. What we intend to do in the next year, and this may be rather ambitious, but I'm hopeful with the level of expertise that we have and the commitment that we've already generated from the people that sit with us at the table, is to really determine through research the impact of the alcohol and other drug problems on the justice system in Minnesota. And by that I mean not only anecdotal information, which we so often and readily can gather, but really the true facts and figures and numbers, and we've already started in that effort, and Ms. Ellison will be able to present some of that information to you shortly. Then also, which is a part of this, the costs associated with the problem on all levels and how it impacts all levels in the system, and the benefits then, and weighing the benefits of the proposed solutions against the cost of the problem. Then identification and assessment of current strategies that we've been able to identify and other strategies I hope we'll still be able to develop and identify to address these issues and identify those that have been created in Minnesota and then look elsewhere out of the state of Minnesota because some very promising strategies we've learned have been developed elsewhere and maybe then look to see what may be applicable to our state. Then the determination of the current and potential effectiveness of drug courts in Minnesota that are already operational and those that are in the planning stage. Then conduct an inventory of the current multi-agency alcohol and other drug efforts in Minnesota at the state level as well as in other states, where again we can identify promising practices and identify gaps and overlaps or redundancies. And we have many of those in Minnesota. And we've certainly come to understand that when we sit collaboratively and talk about which each of our little silos are doing to address the issue. There's a tremendous overlap. And in the time now where we're at with shrinking dollars and resources and at a time when we're trying very desperately to become more effective and efficient with how we address things within the court system, it becomes imperative that we have those conversations in a collaborative way and be able to understand how we can better work together to really be able to trim, I suppose, but still be effective in terms of addressing these issues. And I think from my perspective, there's a real commitment at the table that I've experienced in the last year working with these individuals to really look at that in good faith and be willing to do that. That's become evident already at the individuals who have stepped up from their respective worlds and have said we can do this or we can do that and we're willing to give this or we can share this responsibility. So it's been very heartening to see that already working. So why we're here today really is not specifically to ask for anything from you, but it's really to share information with you so far in terms of what we've gathered to date on what we've managed to do in terms of identifying the impact of alcohol and other drugs on the justice system, and then to share some positive information we've gathered on programs to date that are really making a difference on addressing this issue in Minnesota. Today, as I've already indicated, Mary Ellison is here that will share from her perspective from the Department of Public Safety some information, and Sheriff Jim Frank from Washington County, who's still not here, I understand. I think maybe the sheriff, I know he can get called in on kind of an immediate basis sometimes when things arise in his jurisdiction that he needs to attend to, so perhaps that's not why he's here, but he intended completely to share the law enforcement perspective, and he not only has a perspective from Washington County. Many of you probably know he was a St. Paul police officer with St. Paul for many years, and he also has a responsibility with the Minnesota Drug Task Force, I believe it is. He has a rather unique position in from that perspective. So he kind of has many hats that he wears that he could share his information. So I hope we have the benefit of his input. And also then we have...
Guys, excuse me.
Yes.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you were talking about the task force and using research and scientific research, who is going to do that scientific research?
Commissioner
Smith. Or is it already done?
Representative Smith?
Go ahead.
Representative Murphy. Ms. Ellison, through the Department of Public Safety, has been able to collect some fairly immediate information, and she put together some costs associated with methamphetamine, a methamphetamine case, like a case study of a female offender out of Ramsey County, and also did it for a repeat DWI offender out of Ramsey County, and to try to get all the costs associated with that. I don't know at this point how much, I know within the public safety department and through the Office of Justice Systems within public safety, there's some research I know that has been contracted with the Wilder Foundation to do research on the existing drug courts in Minnesota. That's already underway, and we're looking then through the task force with some money that's already been generated through grant funding and so on under the auspices of the task force that will be working to bring in more additional researchers that will be able to do this. We also have some very valuable and very solid research that's been done already in other states that we'll be able to add on to. We also have done some research in my own district in Ramsey County about our own drug court that's been operational now for 2 years. But other drug courts, at least in terms of that research, from other states that have really been on the ground in doing this, as an example, Missouri, where their population is very comparable to our population in our state. There's a lot of things that we can extrapolate from that research that we'll be bringing into this, too. So we're already on the ground moving forward with that.
Mr. Chair, Justice, is it your intention then to use existing people and analysts and fiscal analysts to collate and extrapolate and gather the information that's already out there? Or are you going to hire a scientific researcher?
Judge Smith.
Well, we certainly want to use the resources that we have in place and to build on that. I understand your question because my background before I was a judge is in sociology, so I'm very attuned to doing scientific research. And I know that there's some criticism oftentimes in the drug court field particularly that the research is not scientific based. We have somebody working with us in Ramsey County that shares that same perspective, the people we're working with. And through that, we're going to make sure that we have the best control groups and do everything to make sure that it's reliable and valid information. So we're very aware of that issue. And in other words, I want it to be valid. I don't want some research that's going to cook the books that nobody will believe. Frankly, I mean, that's my personal perspective, and I expect that I'll be chairing the task force, so that's certainly a perception that I will, or perspective I'll carry forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Judge says I use the word scientific research only because you did, and so I just wanted to just clarify and thought that I had clearer in my mind, and I wish you well. Now tell me about, you said that this is going to take about a year, your task force will take about a year, you have permission to go forth. The people that are on the task force then, from the judicial system, they will be working from their caseloads and time schedule. About how much time do you perceive that they are
going
to be spending on this task force stuff?
Well, since we have not convened our first meeting, and I think that's one of the issues that we'll talk about, I would hope that, well, I can tell you how our state team met. We met typically on a Friday, and we would meet a Friday morning. Our meetings were generally anywhere from 2 hours to 3 hours in length once a month. And then we did an awful lot by email and sharing information that way. So I would not anticipate that we would be able to meet more than once a month. And because I'm anticipating the group will be larger in terms of what the Supreme Court's looking for in terms of its membership, I would expect that we would work in committees and break down some of the work in that fashion, and certainly minimize off the bench time as much as we can, because none of us have the time anymore to be going to any more meetings than absolutely necessary, nor do any of the other people that will sit with us as partners have the time either to be providing that. So there is a lot of staff support already committed by the Supreme Court to this effort through the Court Services Division of the State Court Administrator's Office.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, one last question, Judge Smith. This will be representative of the people on the task force will be representative of the state geographically.
Judge Smith.
Yes, that's correct. That's a very important issue, and also what's important to us is that we have minority representation. That was a big concern of the state team, and we really reached out to the community, and we're looking for ways to ensure that we had those voices with us as well at the table.
Very good. Judge Smith, go ahead and proceed.
All right. Well, I'll turn things over to Ms. Ellison then. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Ellison. I'm Deputy Commissioner in the Department of Public Safety, but I'm here today as a member of the Chemical Health Team. I've been a member of the team since its inception, and really one of the things the team really would like to do is to figure out a way to better integrate treatment with the criminal justice system to try to have a positive impact on reducing chemical dependency and the associated costs to the state of Minnesota, and they have better outcomes for people that are caught up in the system. Somewhere along the line, when we were having discussions about how do we figure out what the costs are of chemical dependency to the state of Minnesota, I volunteered our staff in the Criminal Justice Data Center in the Office of Justice Programs to try to take a crack at figuring out what the costs are to the state of DWI cases and methamphetamine cases. And I've passed out material that I'm certainly not going to go over in detail. I just want to say that this data and research was not done with a surgeon's precision. It was done really to get our arms around as a group, what is it really costing the state to address chemical dependency issues? And so the first thing that we did, I see there's a... The first thing we did is I asked staff to figure out what would the cost be of a quote-unquote typical misdemeanor DWI case, and what would be the cost of a typical, if there is such a thing, methamphetamine case. And you'll see the handout, and again, I'm not going to go through it with detail, but I really want to thank the staff that was involved in this, because everybody they called said to them, you got to be nuts to try to get your arms around this. It's really hard to do. We don't know anybody that's done it. They call all over the place to try to, both here in Minnesota and nationally, to try to figure out if anybody else had ever done this. But so what we did was take a typical case. You'll see in the handout the typical DWI case is where I'm going to start. You can see the case scenario that was developed. We called around to all of the different jurisdictions, to the county attorneys associations, to the probation agency people, to treatment people, to the courts and all over, and put together an estimate that the total public costs of a DWI case can range from $5,902 to $9,152 on average. And again, there's a little chart attached that shows a breakdown of the different costs that we tried to identify that were related to a DWI case in the state of Minnesota. The second document that you have is a case scenario describing a methamphetamine case. And again, it's real important when you're looking at these cases to look at the case scenario and the assumptions that were used, because obviously things change dramatically depending upon the situation that is entailed. What we found with the typical methamphetamine cases, it can range from anywhere to $140,000 to $149,000 per case, which is a very daunting figure. The other thing that I asked our staff to do more recently, and again, I appreciate all of their hard work, was to really look at trying to get a handle on the cost of methamphetamine to the state of Minnesota, methamphetamine use and abuse. Because everybody right now is concerned about methamphetamine, this fall, the commissioner and I and some staff from DPS went around the state and visited with our employees and stakeholders all around the state. Every single place that we visited, people talked about methamphetamine. Law enforcement, crime victim people, the courts, county commissioners, everybody is really, really concerned about methamphetamine. And so what we did, again, was try to take a look at what is the average cost to the state of Minnesota for methamphetamine. And I have, I didn't pass this out to everybody, but I have some of the backup data that supports the different pie charts that you have in front of you. I'll leave some of those with the committee so that you can have those. Our staff called a lot of different sources, and basically, in 2004, from what we can tell, the public costs related to methamphetamine abuse by adults are estimated to total between $120 and $140 million, which, of course, is a huge figure. And this does not include the immediate and long-term health care costs, which, of course, could be substantial. We know that there are additional substantial costs just because of the domestic abuse associated with methamphetamine, homicide, assault, burglaries, identity theft, and all those other things, which we couldn't, of course, factor in. If you look at the pie charts, the immediate impact, if you look at the immediate cases, there's about 5,000 incidences of methamphetamine cases that come to the attention of the police in Minnesota in a year. If you look at the immediate short-term costs over a year, and this is this chart with the two pie charts on it, it shows that for 2004, of the costs that we're talking about, it's about almost 50-50 in terms of the state share and the local cost to local government, with 3% paid for by the feds. But if you look at over the long term, and this has to do with people coming into our prison system primarily, over the long term, the costs of the methamphetamine problem shift from the local area to the state area, so that over time, 64% is borne by the state, 34% local, and 2% federal. There's another chart here that looks like this. And if you just look at the trends in terms of what's happening with methamphetamine in the state of Minnesota, meth treatment admissions from 1999 to 2003 have risen 292%. Meth adult court case filings, 736% increase from 1999 to 2004. The meth prison population from 2001 to 2004 rose 525%. Drug task forces, the 22 task forces that are located around the state, their arrests have increased 79% in the area of meth. And then methamphetamine labs that were seized have gone from 144 labs in 2000 to 410 labs in 2003, or 185% increase. Again, if you look at the chart that talks about the child welfare system, law enforcement, it looks like to us, from what we can tell, of those annual estimated costs, if you look at the ongoing costs of dealing with methamphetamine in Minnesota, it looks like it's about $130 million. And this just divides up who's paying for those costs. $39.3 million, or 30%, is borne by law enforcement, 11%, or $14.8 million, prosecution, corrections, 33%, 42.6%, the environment, 3%, or $3.5 million, treatment, $14.1 million, or 11%, in child welfare, 12%, or 15.7%. So this methamphetamine problem is having a huge impact on the state of Minnesota, on all of our different support systems.
Ms. Ellison, excuse me, Representative Hillstrom, you had a question?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is marvelous and very informative. I still believe that in Hennepin County, crack and cocaine is the primary drug. Do we see numbers in the same financial numbers, do you think, for that drug as we do for meth in the upstate Minnesota in Hennepin County for cost?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, do I understand your question? Is the cost of crack as great as the cost of methamphetamine? Is that your question?
In the metro area.
In the metro area. I don't know the answer to that question, but we can have somebody try to figure that out and get back to you. I honestly don't know. Okay. We focused on methamphetamine for this project just because everybody is so concerned about it at this point in time.
Thank you.
The other thing I just wanted to point out before I it's just a couple things that just stood out to us, to our staff as we were doing this work. In 2004, of the $130 million that, or even more than that for 1 year, but of the great amount of money that we're talking about 11% of those costs were for treatment, and the rest was primarily for the criminal justice system. Women account for a significant number of methamphetamine treatment admissions, in fact, the highest percentage within any drug category. So that relates a little bit to your question, Representative Hillstrom. Over half of those receiving treatment for methamphetamine were age 25 or less. The treatment, this is one thing I wanted to point out just because I think there's been a lot of information in the news about how treatment for methamphetamine addicts is not successful, when in fact, the treatment completion rate for those with methamphetamine as their primary substance of abuse was 58% in 2003, and that this compares to a rate of 65% for those who list other substances as their primary substance of choice. And the Department of Human Services at some point can give a lot more detailed information about that. But I think that's an important thing to point out because there's been so much information of late about how methamphetamine, people addicted to methamphetamine are not successful in treatment. In one suburban county...
Excuse me, Representative Ellison, you have a question.
Sure. Ms. Ellison, could you describe what... completion of treatment actually means? Is it completion of the inpatient program, the outpatient program, both, or and how long after that before there's a relapse? Could you just, so we know a little bit more about what that represents?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, completion in this context means that they've successfully met the treatment goals that they set and they ended their treatment program. It does not allow for follow-up 6 months or 1 year later. I don't have that data with me today, but I'm sure others could provide it.
Representative Ellison, pull your mic down. Thank you.
But, Mr. Chair,
in other words, Ms. Ellison, they did complete the program, and most people did, is what the numbers are showing. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, that's correct.
Right.
In one suburban...
Excuse me, Representative Cornish, you had something here.
Mr. Chair, I was surprised last night. I drove all the way back to Mankato to attend a seminar on methamphetamine prevention and treatment and enforcement, and it lasted a couple hours. It was given by, is it Deb Durkin?
Mm-hmm.
And it was really informative. She's kind of an expert in this field, and she talked about treatment, and I was surprised as a past law enforcement officer, we had heard that meth, you know, was untreatable and you couldn't rehabilitate anybody. But she said that they are having success. It's just the opposite. But it's intense, and the probation and the aftercare, they have to agree to come in, and there's like an 18-month aftercare. You can't just throw them in the detox and cold turkey them like some in the old days. And it involves an intense program of supervision and visits and aftercare, but they are it is successful. But the thing is that if they fall off it, you got to realize how hard it is to quit smoking, and it is so much more terrible with methamphetamine, and so they have to give them another chance. So it involves a long program. So,
Representative Cornish, did you get any information from that seminar that indicated the recidivism of after treatment? How many went back, what percent went back, what percent did not?
No, and in fact, we asked that question, and they do see progress, but they say since the methamphetamine come on so quick and it's relatively new yet, they haven't had the figures to really base a good opinion on, but they said it looks real promising.
Ms. Ellison, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman of the committee, one final point that I'll make. In one suburban county, in Minnesota, social services staff estimates that 47% of the child welfare, child protection cases opened in 2004 were substantially attributable to parental abuse of methamphetamine. The 85 cases involved 148 children at an estimated cost of $900,000 for in-home services and out-of-home placements. So I'll just make that point. With that, I think I'll, I know there are plenty of other people I want to testify. I would just say, too, with the treatment issues, I see Don Eubanks is in the audience from the Department of Human Services now, or at some point, if you have follow-up questions about recidivism, I'm sure he would be able to assist with that.
Okay, I didn't. We're going to go to you in a second. I didn't hear her area of expertise? Who?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Eubanks is in the audience. He's director of the chemical health program at the Department of Human Services, and I'm sure he would have additional information about treatment recidivism and those sorts of issues that the committee would like to ask him later or at some point in time.
Okay, very good. Representative Nelson?
Question I have was about, you've said the child welfare cases. What county was that in?
Mr. Chair,
Ms.
Representative Nelson, it was Anoka.
Judge, where are we?
Mr. Chair, I have a few additional things that I would just like to point out before we move on to the other individuals who will be testifying here. In your packets were provided copies today from Olmsted County of some court calendars, and you can see it's today's date, January 27th. And what the court personnel did was to circle on your copies there cases that actually are on a court calendar today in Olmsted County that are directly alcohol and other drug related. It's somewhat difficult for me not knowing their particular calendaring system, but I suspect this is the minimum number of cases on that calendar. I can tell you from my experience in Ramsey County, at least I would say, and I really believe this is a modest estimate, at least 90% of the cases on our court calendars in any given day, they're either directly alcohol or other drug cases, or alcohol and other drugs is the underlying issue that brings them with whatever behaviors that are exhibited into the court system. It's an incredible impact that we see day in and day out. I've been on the bench for 21 years. Before I was on the bench, I was a Ramsey County public defender full-time. And I worked in that office for a little more than 5 years, I guess, before I went on the bench. I've been on the bench long enough that I am now seeing grandchildren of people that I defended. I mean, grandchildren of people I have defended. Now we're into third generation, where these individuals are coming into the court system, they're cycling into the court system, and it's all about the behavior associated with their chemical dependency. And as we know, chemical dependency is a family disease, and it strikes at the very heart of many, many families, and it just seems to get passed along and passed along and passed along. You know, I think the court system as a whole, and many judges individually, are really waking up to the fact that we have a responsibility to not just sit at the back end of things, and to say, well, you know, the legislature passes the laws, the law enforcement officers carry out, enforce those laws, then the prosecutor prosecutes the case, then we have a court case, and when it gets to the courts, gee, you know, we just are very reactive to what's brought to us. I think we finally understand that we not only have a responsibility, but a wonderful opportunity to talk about our experiences in the community of what we see, not become necessarily an advocate, because then, of course, we're not within our role of a neutral and detached magistrate, of course, as we're sworn to do, but to really talk about what we see. And what we see is the recidivism, the cost, and the wreckage of human lives coming before us every day, not only on the criminal calendar, but in child protection cases. I did that duty a couple of years ago for 2 years. And I would say the vast majority of child protection cases, the underlying reason these people get brought into the system is their untreated chemical dependency issues. And once we see, I mean, that was one of my favorite calendars, and other people told me I was crazy. But I could see hope, because I saw that once we were able to deliver these services and get them effective treatment, so many people were able to get well and to be reunited or to maintain those family relationships. I mean, it was a wonderful opportunity to really see some hope within the court system. We not only see it in child protection, we see it in juvenile court in terms of juvenile delinquency. We have an underage drinking project in St. Paul where we target the 18 to 21-year-olds in terms of underage drinking in the community and all the impact that has on the community. We've seen some wonderful changes in the community as a result of that, partnering with some of the private colleges just within the St. Paul area. I mean, there's wonderful opportunities that we can do and work on within the court system to address these issues. Of course, it's replete across our criminal calendars. You've just heard Ms. Ellison's testimony about methamphetamine cases, but to answer a bit of the question, I think that Representative Hillstrom, thank you, had, I really, in the metropolitan area, we have not yet felt in the courts, I don't believe, the full impact of the methamphetamine epidemic that's sweeping the state. And that right now is the drug that is the new drug. I mean, we had the same kind of, I don't want to call it hysteria, but elevated level of awareness about cocaine when cocaine hit Minnesota a number of years ago. And crack cocaine. I mean, we really had this elevated, oh my God, this is the worst drug that's ever hit the scene. Well, at the time it was. And that's true of methamphetamine in terms of its addictive properties and then all the other things that goes with meth in terms of the environment and exposure of infants like we had with, you know, the cocaine. Now we're learning about crack cocaine exposed babies, the damage, but it's not as bad as what initially was believed to be. So we need some time with all of this. But methamphetamine right now is taken over the outstate areas of Minnesota in a very, very dramatic way. And I think that's why, because it's new and because its impact is not really fully quite understood yet, that's why so much time and attention and focus is being given to that. But to say that they're not solutions, there are solutions, and I think the court system has already tried to address some of the solutions by the establishment of drug courts. We have 17 operational and 10 in the planning stage in Minnesota. I call our court substance abuse court, and I do that deliberately because I want everyone to know that we take in and consider alcohol, in at least in our area, the most used and abused and addictive drug of choice in our community. So we take in alcohol. We have a repeat DWI court that we've just started with federal funds through NHTSA. So it's public safety through NHTSA, the National Traffic Safety Administration group that's understanding that by getting these people into intensive supervision and treatment and supervision within the court setting where you can instill the value of recovery as well as sanctions when those sanctions need to be delivered, as well as the positive rewards, that we can really make a difference in turning people's lives around and, of course, restoring the community to a better situation. So there are already Judge James Dean from Cambridge. He's become sort of a nationally known person and has received awards in that area on staggered sentencing. That's another very promising practice, as well as restorative justice, you know, sentencing circles and other aspects of restorative justice that are very well known. So we are developing things, but we need to develop more, and we're just really excited about the opportunities that exist. Drug courts actually started in 1989 by then head district attorney Janet Reno in Miami, in Dade County, in Miami, in 1989. And they have spread rapidly, drug courts have spread rapidly all throughout the United States. And particularly, I must say, from my somewhat arrogant Minnesota perspective, in southern states, where typically, from my perspective, those are truly the law and order states. You know, I'll tell you, if you get out of Minnesota and go to some of these trainings and see people from all over the country, law enforcement starting some of these programs because they want to see people not coming back to the system, and they're overwhelmed by the extensive manpower that they put on the streets every day and so on. It's just quite remarkable in terms of how these programs have developed around the country, as well as other strategies. I mean, I think there's so many things we've learning about drug courts, and what I've learned from other states, even before Minnesota got involved in all of this, that there's so many of those key concepts of drug courts that we can integrate into all of our case processing within the courts, and that's one of the things I'm hoping our task force will look at as well. So,
Judge, we have a couple of members who have questions. And
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I'm sorry. I get so excited about this that sometimes I lose myself.
I noticed that, Judge, but I'm getting a look, which means
okay.
which means we have questions. Representative Ellison and Hillstrom. Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, Judge Smith, you sit on Ramsey County bench. You see cases come in front of you every day. Are you noticing whether or not meth cases are starting to creep into the metro? I mean, traditionally we've heard it's in outstate or greater Minnesota, but I've sort of been hearing anecdotes about how it's definitely coming into the Twin Cities. What is your experience?
Judge Smith.
Representative Ellison, it's here. It definitely is here. And we're seeing more cases charged that are methamphetamine related. I know that it's not yet at the level that it is outside of the metro area, but you get just out of Ramsey and Hennepin counties into just even those suburban areas now that are really suburban areas in Dakota County and Anoka County and Chisago and, you know, Washington County, and their experience is very different than Ramsey and Hennepin. What's most alarming to me is hearing about how now it's within the schools in the metro area and how teenagers are gravitating towards using methamphetamine for weight loss, young women, for weight loss, for very innocent reasons, you know, not really drug-seeking behavior, but for innocent reasons, or to stay up late night, you know, take exams or whatever, and then very quickly becoming addicted to the effect of that, and then that leading into all kinds of other risky behaviors, and ultimately sometimes finding their way into the justice system. So,
thank you, Jim.
I don't want to delude anybody to say that it's not here, but it's not, from my experience, as big of a problem yet.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm really glad that you brought up schools because that is the one piece with this, the list of expenses that are missing. I have a new young man in my household, a 12-year-old boy who came from a background of drugs in the family. And one of the things that we found is that special education services are a very, very expensive form that should be added to this list of expenses. It really is the children, because these families who are doing the drugs, maybe it's one, but then they have three or four children, and then the next generation, as you said, have the problem. And so I think this is just very, very helpful, this list of costs. And I hope you'll do it for others and maybe even add educational services as well.
Thank you for that suggestion.
Yes, we have one more rep member who has questions, and then I see we have some testimony.
Yes,
from,
we'll take.
Do you have any more to present to us, or you can?
I would, but I will certainly defer. The testimony, I think, that's coming is much more important than anything further I have to say.
We may go to that then now, but Representative Cornish, do you have a question at this point?
Mr. Chair and Judge Smith, I happen to go to one of your drug court seminars, too. And in there, I was wondering about the cost, because now in the methamphetamine seminar last night in Mankato, they actually said that if you could do one of these treatment programs for about $4,000, it was actually lesser than the cost of incarceration, even though it was an intense program. I'm wondering, however, with the drug court, because you're networking with so many different agencies and you're sending these defendants on a different route, are you going to acquire a considerable cost, and are we going to be looking at it? Funding a program in the future as it enlarges or gets bigger, or what's your thoughts on just the cost of the drug court itself versus treatment, or do they go hand in hand?
Judge Smith.
Representative Cornish, my experience, at least, in seeing the development of drug courts in Minnesota, initially, when you're starting up a drug court, I think there are some initial costs that perhaps would cost a little bit more. But that evens out very quickly, and other states that have done the development of courts that we can see have happened. All of the courts, to my knowledge, in Minnesota have started with the assistance of federal funding. But, of course, those funding sources run out very quickly. And we have turned to county funding. Some of our participants pay fees to participate. That's different from district to district, what the expectation is of participant fees. Treatment is paid for through either insurance or through Rule 25 funding. So clearly, if some of the treatment programs were to change to be longer in time to make it more intensive on the treatment end of things, I think that would affect the human services budget. But in terms of impacting the court budget, how that, we're already there doing work anyway, so we're not requiring any extra judicial time, although some judges think that it takes more time. It does initially, but like I say, after a very small period of time, I'd say even my experience is 6 months, I'd say at the most, the cost associated just because of the more intensive time commitment it takes to get things up and running, it levels off.
Thank you.
Let's go to the additional testimony. Now listed on our agenda is Lene and Jim Clark, and is it Jeannie or Jean Noonan? Jeannie? I believe this will be personal testimony. While you're getting set up there, we want to hear everything you have to say, but we probably have about 20 or so minutes left, so be mindful of that as you tell us your story. Go ahead. And we're recording this, so you'll have to state your name for the record, and if there are any questions, you'll have to go through the chair so I can keep a little bit of order and flow to it. So go right ahead, please.
Hi, my name is Lene. I am here to tell you about my husband's and my meth addiction and how it affected my family and ourselves. Our addiction started with marijuana. Don't let your children fool you, because marijuana does lead to harder drugs. As an expert, I can tell you it is not a harmless drug. I started smoking marijuana at the age of 18, and by the age of 21, I had 100 marijuana plants growing in my basement. And at that time, we believed it was not harming our four daughters or us. Looking back now, we realize we were not only isolating ourselves, but our children as well. To give you examples, and I could give you 100 of them, but I don't want to take up that much of your time. We would never allow our children to have friends, sleep over, or come over, nor would we allow them to go over to their friends. Another example is one of my daughters wanted to go to a birthday party, and we asked her where her parents worked. She replied by telling us her dad was a sheriff. We said, no way. She cried and cried and asked why. The real reason was because if she seen or said something wrong, this would get us busted. To lay that on a 5-year-old was robbing her of her childhood. Still to this day, we have guilt of doing that to her. After growing marijuana in our basement for 10 years and isolating our children and ourselves from the world, we progressed into using methamphetamine. We started using meth about 3 years ago. It started out occasionally using it, and then 3 months later, we were manufacturing it. Our children's grades went from A's to D's and F's because we were too busy with our addiction to spend time with them and their homework. My two older daughters, who were the ages of 14 and 16 at the time, would cry and tell us how worried and scared they were for us. Now I look back and the roles were reversed. They were acting as the adults and we were acting as the children. The addiction caused the roles to be reversed. Our only reply to anyone that expressed concerns was, we were fine, we were not addicted, and we could quit anytime we wanted. Looking back now, we realize how close to death we were. It's pretty bad when you have using addicts telling you that they were worried about you. Because of our addiction, we just said they were jealous. We had a federal task force in our backyard. Had we not been addicted, common sense would have told you to quit using everything. But the addiction had progressed so quickly and in such a short time, all we did was hide our drugs away from the house and would bring enough in the house to use for the day so we could get rid of it quickly in case they kicked the door down. Looking back now, it amazes us that we had people that we had seen watching us in our backyard, and yet we continued to use even though everything was on the line for us, our lives and our kids. We would have been in jail for the rest of our lives if we would have got caught. Once, while manufacturing, my husband inhaled anhydrous ammonia and fell to his knees. And the thought that was going through his head was, I never thought I was going to die in the middle of a cornfield. For a minute and a half, he could not breathe in or out or talk. But as soon as he could, he got back up and went back to get more and said he wasn't leaving without it. He just almost died, but the addiction was so strong it forced him right back 15 seconds later to get more anhydrous. But with this addiction, you don't put value on yours or anyone else's life. We continued to use because our addiction was the most important thing at the time. Our two younger daughters, who would have been 7 and 5, were robbed of their whole summer that year. We had go-karts, a trampoline, a swing set, and 5 acres of land for them to have fun and play. But because we were paranoid and being watched, we did not allow them to go outside at all that summer, and we would not go outside with them because we were too busy doing our meth. We never said anything to our younger children about meth or ever used meth or pot in front of them. We never said anything about the people that were watching us. We did not want to scare them. We got to the point that we would leave the house for a short period of time and come home, and I was unable to have my husband drive down the driveway because I would start to hyperventilate. When I started using meth, I was a healthy weight of 135 pounds. But when I started using meth, my weight went down to 95 pounds. Imagine a 5'9 woman at 95 pounds. My husband is 5'9 and was down to 135 pounds. I won't tell you what my weight is up to right now, but I can tell you that my husband is up to a normal weight of 196 pounds, and I am as well up to a healthy weight. When I went into treatment, my counselor told me she never thought I would make it through the night. I guess that is what I get for using meth and not eating. Before entering the Dodge County Drug Court, we were living out of our van. We were to the point and so broke that when we would make a meal, we would make sure the kids would eat first, and what they did not finish, or if there was any left, then we ate. That is how powering meth is over your mind and body. Well, these are just a few examples of how meth affected our family. Now I want to tell you what recovery has been like for my family. Our life has been great since we quit using. I can't say it's been perfect because I feel nobody's life is perfect. There are still things that happen as a result of the addiction, such as my mother-in-law has nightmares about us relapsing and or manufacturing in the middle of a cornfield. Another example is when my husband had to talk to a police about a car that was sitting in a parking spot too long. He had to go down and talk to the police. My two younger daughters were screaming and holding on to him and telling him, "No, Daddy, don't go." Even though nothing was going to happen, I could not calm them down. They were screaming the whole while he was out there. This worries me because they seem to be terrified of the police. This is not right. They need to know the police are their friends and they are there to help them. And we are working on it. We thought that we hid the people in the backyard from them, yet 3 months ago they seen a police car go by our house with its lights on and they ran to the backyard. And we found them looking for the people in the woods. But we deal with these things one day at a time, and one day at a time things will get better. I have been able to hold down a job for the first time in my life. I have been working at the same job for over a year now, and I have currently accepted a job at the Mayo Clinic out of Rochester. I have currently received my GED, and my plans are to go on to school and become an LPN. My two older daughters who are now 20 and 18. They are both doing well. Our 18-year-old daughter is graduating this year at the top of her class and was in the finals to become homecoming queen and wants to go on to college. They both tell us they are very proud of us. Our two younger daughters are also doing well. Our 10-year-old daughter is tried out for a musical and has received a part in the play. She is also running for student council and is also in band. Our 8-year-old is having a lot of fun with all of her friends. She really enjoys irritating her older sisters, but I guess that's what the youngest child's hobby usually is. They can now have friends over and we have nothing to worry about. We always have food in the house so we don't have to worry about just feeding the kids. I was a Jehovah's Witness for 18 years of my life. My husband, when he was younger, wanted to go to school to become a priest. We went from being very spiritual when we were both younger to becoming addicts and having no contact with our higher power out of guilt. Now in our recovery, we are back in contact with our higher power. We both started to wonder if there was a higher power and why he had abandoned us. Looking back now in our sobriety, we know he never left our side, or neither one of us would be here today. It is like the poem, Footsteps in the Sand. We believe the Dodge County Drug Court was the answer to our prayers. We believe without the Dodge County Drug Court, we would not have 18 months of sobriety today. We had both been in treatment one other time, but without the drug court system, I am sure we would not have our sobriety today. We would either be dead, in prison, or in an asylum. These are just the end results if you continue using meth. I believe it is one of Satan's most powerful tools in the destruction of God's children. Dodge County is on the front line and is one of the few to have this problem in the state and the nation. This program in the state and the nation. Thank you again for listening and caring.
Thank you, Ms. Clark. Mr. Clark, you have something to add.
I'd like to start out by saying I am both honored and thrilled to be given this opportunity to tell you our story of addiction and what the drug court has done for us. My addiction started out with marijuana and alcohol at the age of 15. I never thought at the time marijuana was harming me. I realize now it was the start of the next 30 years of a foggy haze. At the age of 18, I dropped out of school and joined the Navy. I was accepted into submarines. I was to go into nuclear electronics in New London, Connecticut, and begin sub-training. To give you an example of how the addiction of marijuana had affected me already, I was 18 years old, was accepted into nuclear electronics, offered a push-button advance to third-class petty officer, and I gave it up in a heartbeat so I could continue to smoke marijuana. I chose an aircraft carrier so I could go hide and smoke my marijuana. Once while in Japan, I snuck 3 ounces of marijuana onto our ship. If I had been caught in Japan, it would have been a life sentence in a Japanese prison. This is how a marijuana addiction affects your life. I was discharged after serving 3 years in the Navy. I continued to smoke marijuana for the next 30 years, bouncing from job to job with really no future. Marijuana, I believe, is a slow, sneaky, future-robbing drug. Then I tried meth and all half broke loose. I didn't realize it, but I had jumped from the slow ride to nowhere onto the interstate to hell. Within 3 months of trying meth, I was manufacturing to supply myself. I was growing marijuana and manufacturing meth. You think you will only do it for a little while, but I have never known anybody that used meth or marijuana that could stop before it was gone. And then your whole life revolves around getting more. I started to pawn off anything and everything I owned to buy more meth and marijuana. I have had guns pointed in my face and never even thought twice about the danger of dying. The drug becomes your higher power and you are powerless. It was not the first time or the last time my life was in danger. Within 2 months of starting to manufacture, we had a drug task force in our backyard. We knew they were watching us, so we just hit our meth and brought enough to use for the day. We used to watch them at night running around in black ski masks and camouflage. We were risking losing our kids and our freedom for the rest of our lives, but we are helpless with this addiction. You don't even think twice about risking your life. When you do come down, you feel like dying and you wish you would, and it crosses your mind more than once as an optional. I remember saying a prayer one night for a way out. I was sick of having nightmares of my nightmares. Now I will tell you how I believe the drug court was the answer to that prayer. We ran into the Dodge County Drug Court about 2 months after saying that prayer. After 30 years of drinking and drugging, I have 18 months of sobriety. There is no doubt in my mind I would not be here today without this program. This program has taught me to live, love, and learn. It has taught me to forgive myself and forgive others. With the drug court's strong belief in the encouragement, I have received my GED after being out of school for 28 years. I received a perfect score in science and reading. I scored in the top 1% in the state. I plan on pursuing further education. I never believed in myself enough to think I could accomplish this. The drug court taught me to believe in myself. I went from rejecting society to trying to become part of society. I went from believing nothing was possible to anything is possible. I'm employed full-time and have been since joining the drug court. I no longer want to be part of the problem, but part of the solution. I have straightened out my taxes after a 10-year mess. After being in debt as much as $30,000 in child support, February 15th, I will be paid up in full. I did this all in a year and a half. The drug court has taught me how to face my problems head on. I have hopes and dreams again. I am high on life. If you would have told me I would be saying that today 2 years ago, I would have said you're high on something. I honestly believe an addict does not stand a chance at sobriety without this program. A basic treatment plan is not effective by itself. The drug court attacks this disease and addresses all aspects of your life. They leave no stone unturned. They address it physically, emotionally, and spiritually if you choose. Participants are not let off scot-free. We are held accountable for our fines and partial payment of our drug court fees. If we are unsuccessful in the completion of the program, our sentence will be executed. Meth will destroy individuals, families, communities, and eventually nations if not for programs like Dodge County Drug Court. The cost to not fund a drug court in the end could cost millions. Who knows what it has cost so far? As it is a fact, addiction does not care what color your skin is, how rich you are, how intelligent you are. I sometimes wonder, has addiction buried the cure to cancer? Is a Nobel Peace Prize winner sitting in an asylum? Imagine the cost to society if it has or is allowed to. One last note. For the first time in my life, I am a registered active voter, tax-paying productive citizen of the United States and proud of it. Thank you again for this opportunity.
To the clerk, thank you. And then Ms. Newman.
Hi, my name's Jean Newman. I'm from Isani County. Judge Dean asked me to be here. He's in Washington, D.C., working on his staggering sentencing program with other members throughout the United States. I have 40 DWIs in the last 12 years, a repeat offender. I went before Judge Dean. My last two DWIs were 2 months apart, June, one in August. He offered me the staggering sentencing and with other conditions. I'll make this short. What the staggering sentence did for me, it held the jail time. He put the two sentences together and they ran consecutively. He hung the jail time over my head. There were conditions I had to meet being on probation, and these were tough conditions. And Judge Dean, he'll stick to his word. If you mess up on your probation, he has no qualms of sending you to prison. I wasn't going to let that happen. I was in Dysani County Jail. for sentenced for 20 days, in which part of my term was I had a sentence to serve, so I got out in 10 days, and that was tough. You have every resource available to you through the court system, what Judge Dean has put up. Where you don't have my other DWIs, nobody said anything. This was 12 years ago, but there were no mention of treatment, no mention of how you get help, how you get sober. Judge Dean makes a special point. He gives you everything you need, different treatment options, health recovery seminars, not just, you know, about your health. I went to so many things that I was ordered to do, and once I started doing all these things, it all started sinking in. I had tried AA before. I hated it. I just hated it. But I went along with it. This time, something sank in, and I think it was Judge Dean, because he really cares about people, and he's passionate about this staggering sentencing. And I know he uses it a lot because I go before him for motions to get electronic monitoring stayed. And the last time I was there, there were 63 people from three counties, Isani and a couple other counties up north. 63 people. And we were all going through this staggering sentencing. And every one of them was a success story just in that court. You say, well, how can that be a success for 63 people here? But they're not tying up our prison system, our jail system, and they're getting the help they need. And I love what he's doing. I mean, he has helped me so much. I'm back with my family. I'm working again. I can't say enough about the staggering sentencing. And
Representative Cornish, question.
I guess it would be to Lene and Jim first. First of all, congratulations. You did a good job today testifying. It looks like you escaped rather luckily without any of the disfiguration and the teeth and the skin ticks and the things that some people end up with. If people get into it later, if they're caught later, when this process starts, a more degenerative process physically and mentally, is there still hope for them too in this program, you think, a detoxification and treatment? Or is there a certain place that you just go over the edge and there's no bringing you back? And then, if I could, another question, is this craving still there, or do you still have to fight it like an alcohol for the rest of your life? And what do you think your success outlook is from now here?
This is Carter.
For the craving part, the cravings will always be there, but we have been given the tools to learn how to deal with these cravings and how to subside them, and they do eventually go away. Do you want to address the others?
Yeah, we'll always be out there, you know, but we've been given the tools, like Lene said, by the drug lord, on how to deal with that. Take it one day at a time. Never look too hard at it. As far as, I don't think it's ever too late for anybody to treatment.
Mrs. Clark, is Clark or Mr. Clark, give us some nuts and bolts, mechanical answers, if you will. When you went to drug court, did the judge put some time over your head and then tell you to give you the option to do certain things? How much time was hanging over your head, if you will?
We had a prison term of a year and a day hanging over our head. We had the option to execute our sentence or enter into the Dodge County Drug Court. They gave the option to us. We had the option to say, no, I don't want to go into this program and execute my sentence. But I feel if we would have done it that way around, as soon as we would have got out of prison, we would have been right back out there using again.
And when, what month and year was that you made that choice? When was that?
That was the month of July of the year 2003.
And have you been discharged from drug court? Has your time been discharged, or are you still connected with the court?
I'm currently, we both are currently still enrolled in the Dodge County Drug Court. Our graduation date is set for April 14th of this year.
So that's about a two-year period of time. And when your discharge happens or your graduation date happens, does the time that was hanging over your head go away?
Yes, it does.
Okay, so it's a two-year monitoring program that you're telling us about.
Yes.
How do you have periodic drug checks of your blood or your urine?
We have, every Thursday when we go into court, we have UA. When we meet with our caseworkers before drug court, we have a UA done also. And also the sheriffs are out there doing random knock and chat, they call them. We don't know when they're coming. That's why we have a curfew set, so we are at home if they do show up to do a UA.
When is your curfew? What time of the
night? Right now it is at 11 o'clock, but when you start your first phase, it is at like 6:30 p.m.
So for 2 years you have to go back to a place, the court, at every Thursday morning?
Yes.
And you get tested to see if there's drugs in your system?
Yes.
And they can come at any time other than any time else to also test you, is that right?
That's correct.
About how many times a month, if you know, do they come unannounced?
I've been tested as many as 6 times in a week. It's just random so that you don't know.
So you go to court on a Thursday, and before the next Thursday rolls around, you've been knocked on the door 6 times and have had a test.
Right.
Okay.
It's possible.
It tends to keep your mind on your task, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's good.
Yeah. I went to treatment, inpatient treatment for 30 days, and there were people smoking marijuana in the room. With this program, they've got it covered. I mean, if there was a way to use and get away with it, I'd know about it, and there's not. They've got it covered. They check for cleaners, you know, everything. So,
does any other member have a nut and bolt question about what happens during those 2 years? Representative Ellison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me congratulate all three of you again. I truly believe that, you know, you all did a very courageous and great thing by coming here, and you've helped us out a lot. So thank you for what you're doing for yourself, for your children. My question is this: what is the treatment component? Did you go to a 30-day, a 15-day? What exactly did you do for treatment, and what's the aftercare? Could you just describe your course of treatment?
Mrs. Clark, you've taken the lead, so why don't you go on? Go ahead.
When we entered into the Dodge County Drug Court, we went enrolled into an outpatient program and did 60 days of outpatient, and then aftercare was like a 6-week program also. So that is that component. I guess I forgot the rest of your question.
Mr. Chair, the rest of my question is that after you did your 6 weeks of aftercare, do you still have is there still an ongoing component of your treatment? Do you have to attend like NA meetings or anything like that?
Yeah.
Just sorry. Go ahead.
Yes, we have AA meetings. We are required to go to 3 AA meetings a week. We have sponsors that we are required to meet with weekly. As far as meeting with your caseworker weekly, we have to have when you start a once a week meeting with them, and then as the phases come along, that will drop also as for the meetings, because you have proven yourself and your status with the drug court as being good. Guess I don't know.
Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair.
One last question.
Yes, sir. Do you know, I mean, you may not know this, but do you know what the cost of your treatment was?
I guess I could not tell you because I was under a Rule 25.
Right. You were ordered to go, but...
Right. I don't know the cost of it.
Judge Smith, I'm going to ask you to come forward and take no more than, please, 2 minutes. wrap up, because we do want to all get to session relaxed and ready for a long session on the floor. Judge Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to wrap up, I would just again like to thank you and the testimony from these individuals. I think when you share your personal story with a group of strangers and to do it very publicly can be very terrifying, and I think it's very courageous. And I think by you really seeing the face of someone who has been and is an addict, but you can also, on the other hand, see the face of recovery and the hope that there is in recovery. And that, I think, is a very powerful story that no numbers or statistics can tell. All I would like to really say is that we hope to come back early next session, next year, in 2006, and report to the appropriate committees of the legislature as to what the progress has been of the task force. And I would just hope that you would continue in whatever way you can from your respective roles to support the work of the task force by keeping informed in terms of how we're moving forward. And if you do have any suggestions or information you would like, or from your particular constituencies that you would like the task force to consider to forward it to us, I'm sure there'll be members of the legislature that are part of this task force as well, and the Supreme Court's making that decision right now in terms of who the individuals will be that will comprise the task force. But I think it's very important that we receive information as well of areas of interest and concern. We're not here today asking for any money, any funding, anything like that. We're just asking for your support in the endorsement of the concept of the task force, I suppose, and just sharing information with us. And again, very much I appreciate the opportunity that you've given us today. I would only encourage any members here from your respective parts of the state, if you do have a substance abuse court or some project, an intensive DWI supervision program, an underage project going on, anything in your community, to really, the judges, we'd like to do judicial, we call them judicial ride-alongs. We'd love you to come to court and experience what we're doing, but this is one particular area. If you're aware of something going on in your community, to take the opportunity to do that. And I know when you're here in St. Paul in session, you're here, and so anytime you're more than welcome to come to Ramsey County. We're just down the street here. We do our adult drug court on Thursdays, and we do our juvenile drug court on Wednesdays. So all you need to do is just give us a call, and we'd be more than happy to accommodate you and share any information with you.
Judge, I also will expect and ask and invite you to come back 1 year from now, roughly 1 year. We will all be here. And give us a further report. One of the best ways to figure out if a task or a treatment is working is to monitor it and see if it's effective. And therefore, I would like to invite, and I would ask all three of our citizens, Mr. and Mrs. Clark, Ms. Noonan, I'd ask you to come back a year from today and report to us on your personal progress. And we know it'll be exemplar, but I'm inviting you now to come back, and we will notify you a day, approximately a year from now, and to report on this issue. Before we go, members, Representative Cornish moves approval of the minutes from the January 25th, 2005 meeting. Is there any discussion on those minutes? If not, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
As opposed, no. Also, Representative Johnson moves approval of the minutes from January 26, 2005. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
As opposed, no. Those minutes are approved. Representative Hilstrom, did you want to keep us here for one last question? Shoot.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you tell me, with the drug court, if there are other family court issues and maybe the children are in juvenile court, do you concentrate all those cases together then, or are they still all separate?
We're in the planning stage of a family dependency court with all the child protection cases. To have the regular child protection caseload handled in the regular court setting, but to take cases out of there and put them into a dependency drug court, the parents into a dependency drug court, to more intensively work on the treatment issues. So they'll be kind of working side by side. The juvenile drug court that we have going now is juvenile delinquency cases that are in a drug court setting.
I did not want to impose on any of the three testifiers as if I can require you to come back. Do I have your approval, though?
Yes, yeah. You do.
Do I see nods from all three?
Yeah.
Very good. Thank you. This meeting is adjourned.
Thank you so much.